Hey, Tenderfoot listeners. I'm Liam Luxon, host of Status Untraced, a new podcast brought to you from the team behind Up and Vanished. It follows my investigation into the disappearance of Justin Alexander, a survivalist and world traveler whose life seemed like it was torn from the pages of an adventure novel. While some of Justin's friends and family believe he may have been murdered, it's not clear what actually happened. And a message he left behind just days before he vanished makes everything about his disappearance just strange. Check out this clip featuring one of Justin's friends and their recollection of their final conversation with him.
It was one thing that kind of made me feel weird about whenever he'd talk about his plans for India. And the more I've thought about it, especially over the years, it almost seemed like he was preparing for something because he wanted to be famous. He made that openly clear, like that was his end goal.
When you hear the message Justin left behind, when you hear about the remote and dangerous area where he went missing, when you learn about how the suspects and the police's efforts in this case all quietly started to fade away, you won't be able to stop wondering what happened. From Tenderfoot TV, Status Untraced is available now. Listen for free on Apple Podcasts or subscribe to Tenderfoot Plus to binge the entire season ad-free. Learn more at tenderfootplus.com.
It was just the adventure of it all. Predominantly the musical adventure of it all.
This is Dean Budnick, an American historian and jam band guru who's very well versed on the Grateful Dead.
Music in the 1980s with all those synthesizers and MTV, it was so tightly produced. Everything was given to you, was handed to you. There was little that was new that one could discover. The music of the Grateful Dead is about being on the edge, not knowing what's happening from one moment to the next musically, and feeling like the band didn't either. Being on this collective journey with the band, 18,000 people in the arena with me. There's an incredible rush to everyone joining one another on this journey, searching for some profound experience. We're all going to get lost, and eventually, the band's going to lead us to the promised land. More often than not, the Grateful Dead would do just that.
Thousands of young people seeking adventure, but sometimes with that came a unique vulnerability.
People in their teens and 20s who have that expectation that it's all peace and love. There are going to be some individuals who are going to see those vulnerable people and understand how they can take advantage of them. Some folks are going to prey on vulnerable, tend to be younger people, relying on the kindness of strangers who believe in what they think of as that Grateful Dead ethos, that 1960s lifestyle. You would see this at times. You know, some people would walk out of shows just spun, dosed, unclear of where they are, but feeling pretty good, and they need to get to the next show. I definitely can recall driving to see the Grateful Dead from Cambridge, Mass, out to see him at Deer Creek in Indiana. Getting up in the morning, getting up, tickets falling into my hand, boom, I'm gone. And it went down to the wire. I finally get in, it's almost showtime. I run into the venue, have an amazing show, walk out and realize I have no idea where my car is. I've been so fixated on getting into the show and finally making it into the lot that I literally have no idea where my car is. And I remember just walking around and seeing a group of people about my age in their 20s. They'd made a little fire. And they said, come on. And I'm like, no, I'm looking for my car. And they're like, yeah, that's what we lost our car too. We're just making this little fire here. And then when all the other cars are gone, that's where our car will be. It's easy to imagine how people can come out of that feeling very, very vulnerable. Someone says, hey, come on with us. Let's go back to the hotel or let's go on to the next city. Join us, be part of what we're doing. part of the Grateful Dead experience as well, is searching. The music of the Grateful Dead is about finding what's next, being on the edge. The Grateful Dead are all about this seeking out what's next. I'm gonna do the same when I get out of the show and get out in the lot. And if people have ill intent, it's pretty easy to find the individuals who can be preyed upon. I saw my fair share of wolves in sheep's clothing out there on tour.
Mary was found with a male companion in the Berkeley, California marina on Thursday. Both had a single gunshot to the head. Mary Joya was a 1981 graduate of Niskayuna High School, and she received a culinary arts degree from Schenectady County Community College. Her mother describes her as industrious and trusting. Early reports said Mary was a devout follower of the Grateful Dead rock group.
On August 16, 1985, 18-year-old Greg Niffen and 22-year-old Mary Joya were murdered. They were Grateful Dead fans, staying the night in a small homeless encampment called Rainbow Village in between shows.
Mary was a loving person. She loved everyone in the family. I think that some of the things that have been said about Mary being a deadhead or following the Grateful Dead out to California are untrue. I know they're untrue.
Mary's mother, Patricia, was unhappy with the way the news media was labeling her daughter as a quote-unquote deadhead. With that term came a certain connotation.
In the language of the vernacular here, she was laid back. She was a very special free spirit, we might call her. But let me also say that Mary was industrious. Never did she sit around and not have a job.
Mary grew up in Schenectady, New York. According to her mother, she loved nature, traveling, and being outdoors. She was also somewhat of an activist. She was part of the Coalition to Stop Food Irradiation, an animal rights action group. She was not someone you would associate with drugs or partying. This made the horrific news of her murder all the more shocking. It had always been Mary's dream to move out west, and after a few years on her own, she moved to California, with no job, no mailing address, and no home. At the time of her murder, she had only been in California for a number of weeks. Though the Joya family knew the real Mary, the news had already latched onto the term deadhead to describe her.
Mary's mother said she did not go to California to follow the Grateful Dead, although she was a fan of theirs. She was not a so-called deadhead, and she was not involved in drugs. Her mother says she thinks Mary attended the June Dead concert at SPAC, but says she was not a devotee.
Deadheads were not part of the mainstream, right? They were the other. To the media, to the police, people thought they were freaks. When in many times they were nothing but the most peaceful people just finding their own way, finding their own path. I think a lot of those individuals will be looked at differently through the lens of 2020. But because of that, when incidents would take place, I'm not convinced local officials would always take them seriously. When you find somebody, whether it's a Jane Doe, but maybe you think she's from somewhere else, it's not necessarily the same priority as when a local citizen is the victim of a crime. The Grateful Dead uniformly was not seen as this hallowed band of yore. You know, I think they viewed themselves, quite honestly, as freaks, people who were outside of mainstream culture. Because of that, it seems logical to assume that it's going to be more challenging for individuals to secure justice. Someone who's just passing through, and someone who's passing through with this freak band. In the 80s, Grateful Dead fans were pretty widely disparaged in a way that's lost to history.
The details of their murders were only still emerging. What little they did know was awful. Both Mary and Greg had been badly beaten and shot at close range with a high-powered rifle. Their bodies were then dragged and thrown into the bay. Mary's family, her mother, father, two sisters, and five brothers, were over 2,000 miles away in upstate New York. During the next few days, they waited anxiously for the next phone call from police. Their murders, like many others in the Grateful Dead world, remained a mystery.
Mitchell Fred Weiser and Bonita Bickwick were just passing through. Not in the 80s, however, but in the early 70s, in 1973 to be exact, to a Grateful Dead concert. A band whose reputation as a freak flag flying band of dangerous traveling musical hippies was already firmly cemented. A few years prior, in October of 1967, the band's home at 710 Ashbury Street in San Francisco was raided, without a warrant, mind you, by rock-ribbed authoritarian establishment squares in blue, otherwise known as cops or piggies if you were even further to the left of the late 60s counterculture movement that the Dead and their fans trucked with.
Everyone on the fucking ground and keep your hands where we can see them or we're gonna start swinging.
The cops flooded in and began ransacking the joint immediately. Behind them, out on the street, was an assembled group of local media who'd been tipped off about the bust. Inside, the cops went to work with the quickness, rifling through the office of Dead manager Rock Scully, which was really just a giant desk in the house's living room with no chairs and plenty of piled up paperwork and some loose cash, which San Francisco's finest, of course, liberated from the clutch of the presumed pinko commie hippies. The cops tore through the rest of the house in search of what one narcotics agent referred to as the killer weed. Emptying ashtrays, knocking over bottles of Rotgut, Nitrine, White Port, and Ombre, these completely legal intoxicants, of course, all belonging to Dead harmonica player Ron Pigpen McKernan. And they pulled and tossed their way through the house's record collection, too. Maybe some contraband was hidden in there, they thought, paying little regard to the cultural importance of what they were thumbing through. Jerry Garcia's John Coltrane albums, albums that would have a profound impact on the improvisational approach Jerry and his bandmates would hone and master throughout the rest of their career, following the tenor saxophonist method of allowing his quartet members to solo right alongside him, exploring together at the same time the far reaches of improvisational playing to eventually land right back at the song's original melody. Perfect synchronicity. The cops got to Pigpen's John Lee Hooker and Little Walter albums, oblivious that it was this down-home, lonesome, snake-charm blues music that kept the Grateful Dead anchored into the roots of Americana. And then they got to guitarist Bob Weir's stash. Not the kind of stash the cops were trying to find, mind you, but if they had listened, they'd have found it every bit as mind-altering as the substances they sought. It was McCoy Tyner's recently recorded The Real McCoy, a solo album by the Coltrane Quartet pianist that Bobby would study more than any other guitar player in an effort to learn how to properly complement Jerry's rapidly advancing rock and roll guitar exploration. These records and more, from classical pieces composed by Wagner that belonged to bassist Phil Lesh to the soul and R&B that drummer Bill Kurtzman adored. The Tito Puente albums belonged to recently added second drummer and percussionist Mickey Hart. He hadn't been with the band long, but he threw himself right into the communal living ideals, mixing his music with the other band members, both physically and spiritually. The treasure trove of valuable musical inspiration, the pigs just tossed it off with total disregard. To serious students of music like the Grateful Dead, this disrespectful treatment of what were essentially religious relics to them was as serious an affront by the cops as anything else that had happened up to that point. And the cops were clueless but determined. They then went at the kitchen, working their way around remnants from Bob Weir's latest macrobiotic cooking experiment and neglecting, somehow, to locate the 2 pounds of grass stashed away in the cupboard. Phil Lesh's girlfriend, or to use the vernacular of the day, Phil's old lady, Florence, was told to sit in the kitchen. She grabbed some neglected ice cream melting in a bowl and surreptitiously squirreled out the 3-gram ball of hash from her purse, threw it in the bowl, quickly mixed it into some sort of barely edible concoction and gulped it down. The raid roused Bob Weir, who was meditating in the attic, and stirred Pigpen, who was entertaining guests in his bedroom. These two members, along with Rock Scully and equipment manager Bob Matthews, Florence, and 6 others, were arrested on narcotics charges for the marijuana the cops did find. Pigpen's legal Beretta handgun was also seized. Jerry, Phil, Bill, and Mickey were elsewhere and thus escaped the coming hassle. The Grateful Dead's booking was newsworthy, of course, and so a press conference was held by the band back at 710 Ashbury in their living room.
following the great dead.
The police, in making arrests, prefer to concentrate on individuals who have been manufactured by the mass media into a group that typifies the now popular image of the drug-oriented hippie. But the hippie, as created by the media, is a lie. The larger society has classified and categorized them into a myth of the hippie.
The way we feel and the way we went.
The long-haired dropout who performs his exotic rites for the convenience of visiting cameramen.
They view themselves
concerning the Grateful Dead, since they're a nationwide and worldwide organization.
The Grateful Dead in 1967, at the time of the bust at 710 Ashbury, were definitely fast on their way to becoming a worldwide organization. So much so that by 1973, they were turning on ungodly amounts of young fans at what was then the biggest rock and roll concert of all time. With 600,000 people in attendance, the Watkins Glen gig was bigger than Woodstock. By most accounts, all in attendance had a great time. All but two. All but Mitchell Fred Weiser and Bonita Bickwick, 16 and 15 years old, respectively. Depending on who you talk to, they were either last seen getting into a VW bus, hitching a ride, or dipping into a nearby river for a cool dip. But either way, after that day, out at Watkins Glen to see the Dead, young Mitchell and Bonita were never seen or heard from again. They were gone, in the wind, just like that. Like the last strands of a fiery riff from Jerry's Alligator Strat. Like the feedback from the band's emerging wall of sound. Like Mary Gioia and Greg Niffen 12 years later, fellow deadheads not much older than Mitchell and Bonita were at the time. Who, just like them, would seek out peace and connection in the coziness of the Grateful Dead community and pay the ultimate price. There in 85, so alive. Then, dead and gone.
In the days following Mary Gioia and Greg Niffen's murder, the police were combing Rainbow Village for answers. On the night of August 16, 1985, there were a few dozen people there, many of whom were permanent residents, living in buses or vans. But there was also several Grateful Dead followers there, a free place to stay. Within a few hours of the investigation, the police had focused their attention on one man in particular, a 31-year-old African-American man named Ralph International Thomas. 10 days after their murders, Ralph was arrested. No witnesses, no murder weapon, and no DNA evidence. After a trial that lasted several weeks, Ralph International Thomas was found guilty.
Prosecution's case at trial relied on circumstantial evidence putting Ralph International Thomas with the victims the night before they were murdered.
This is John Seasley. He runs a nonprofit called Injustice Watch, where he conducts in-depth research into wrongful convictions. In recent years, he started tracking Ralph's case.
There's no evidence directly tying him to the murders themselves. No physical evidence. His defense attorney, James Chaffee, did absolutely no follow-up investigation to a crucial eyewitness who puts another man with the victims later than anyone else. Credible evidence pointing to an alternate suspect. You have essentially a question mark hanging over what could have been. This woman, Vivian Searcy, puts a white blonde-haired man with the victims later than anybody else, yet he does no further investigation. He had the opportunity, he had resources to, and he did not do any kind of follow-up.
According to court documents, on the night of the murders, a woman named Vivian Searcy was staying in Rainbow Village. At around 1:30 a.m., Vivian drove to a nearby dumpster. As she got out of her car, she noticed two white men, one brown-haired, one blonde, and a woman standing near the dumpster. She later testified after seeing pictures that the woman was Mary Gioia, and the brown-haired man was Greg Niffen. She described a tall, skinny, blonde-haired man holding a long stick-like object in his hand, which appeared to be a rifle. Off in the distance, Vivian heard these three people talking. The blonde man asked, "Do you think she's seen anything?" The brown-haired man says no, she couldn't have. The woman then said to the blonde man, "You have to give it back." Then one of the men said, "This could mean money to us. We need this." The woman, presumably Mary Gioia, responded saying, "I don't want any part of this. I'm going." And then walked down the hill away from the men. Vivian Searcy then heard the blonde-haired man say off in the distance, "I'll take care of this." The blonde man walked down the hill away from the village following the woman. About 15 minutes later, she heard three loud noises that sounded like firecrackers. Around 90 minutes after hearing the noises, she saw the blonde man again. This time, he was walking up from the waterfront and was seen wiping his hands on the nearby grass and vegetation. At this point, Vivian was frightened and decided to move her car. As she made her way back towards the gates of Rainbow Village, she saw the blonde man again. He was washing his hands and his hair in the sink outside the gates. He was shirtless and appeared to be washing his shirt too. Later that night, at approximately 4 a.m., a man knocked on her car window. He was wearing a long coat, and she couldn't see his face. The man asked her name and where she was staying. Vivian responded, "Why all these questions?" The man stared at her and replied, "Because I'm going to kill you." The man then turned around and walked away.
Obviously, there's an implication that his hands are dirty from committing these two murders, wiping his hands on the tall grass growing around there. If evidence comes out after a trial that points to your innocence, it can be years or decades before any action is taken, regardless of how clear-cut that evidence might be. While a murder trial happens relatively quickly, the appellate process usually takes decades.
Despite this pretty compelling testimony from Vivian Searcy, Ralph International Thomas was ultimately convicted. For the next three decades, Ralph continued to plead his innocence, and his case went through a roller coaster of appeals. His fight for a retrial was spearheaded by attorney Alex Reisman. I spoke to Alex.
You can't win a case if you don't fight for your client, if you don't do the work.
No real work was done to defend this man at trial. That's a tragedy. Here's a case where there's no weapon, there's no forensic evidence, no eyewitness. There was nothing that really directly tied him in except bad circumstantial evidence. It was a rush to judgment case, and that really became clear to us. The cops focused on him and some circumstantial evidence, and they built the case. They were both beaten. They had been both dragged along the gravel and both put into the bay. It's sad. It was a brutal crime, and they were shot with some kind of a high-powered rifle. Weapon was never found, but it was a weapon that did a lot of physical damage to the body. There was so little direct evidence. International was involved in this in any way. The best evidence was Vivian Searcy, who had given a credible account of an alternative perpetrator that was never in any way investigated, a guy named Bo.
The blonde-haired man Vivian saw that night had a name. He was known only as Bo.
Vivian, she's the one who saw them closest to the time of death. She said that Greg and Mary and a guy named Bo were together in the parking area away from where people lived, and they were arguing. Mary was expressing grave concerns because he had something.
He had apparently taken something. It's not ours. And he said, no, this is money. This could be money to me. She's arguing with him and saying, don't do this. And then he looks at Vivian Cersei and says to the other two, do you think she's hurt us? Vivian, 10 or 15 minutes later, hears three shots, three explosions, three firecrackers, three sounds that are like gunshots. That's what we know. I think the story is one of a lot of stories. System pointing to a black man and saying, you're it. He was the black guy. He was the black guy at Rainbow Village. It's sadly not unusual. It's the way the criminal justice system all too often works in this country. The wrong person gets convicted, and it's easier still when the wrong person is the wrong color. It's not like juries are immune from systemic racism. We're all born. We're all born and bred with it. It's in our mother's milk. Dog whistles might not work the exact same way that they work in Montgomery, Alabama in 1962, but they work on enough so that it's helpful for the prosecution. We had to go through all of the twists and turns of appeals.
Ralph was given the death penalty in 1985. In 1986, an appeal was filed. In 1990, Ralph's attorneys filed the first habeas corpus petition, an application to be released from prison, based on the grounds of an inadequate public defense. In 1991, the California Supreme Court denied the habeas corpus. Later that year, a second was filed, which was again denied. It happened just like this for another two decades. In 2012, a writ of habeas corpus was granted. Ralph Thomas was issued a retrial. But by that point, it was too late.
Ann had diabetes, ill health, and it was not cared for, was very sick. And when the case was sent back to Alameda Superior Court for his retrial, he passed away. He died in prison, and that's a tragedy. The life was basically snuffed out. He got sick in prison, he got diabetes. They don't really take great care of you in prison. And maybe less care on death row. It's frustrating and sad. He did not deserve to be in prison. He shouldn't have been in prison. And he should have gotten out. The case was still in the pretrial stage. We tried to get him out because he was very ill. He was harmless to anybody, but the court wouldn't let him out. It's sad. He never got out of prison.
If somebody is in prison for a crime that they didn't commit, that means somebody is not in prison who did commit that crime. That crime happens to be murder. He's walking around free, having been completely uninvestigated as a suspect. It raises the question of what our criminal justice system is really designed for. There is no statute of limitations on murder. Being able to look back at this case 35 years later, I feel like knowing the truth is important. If Vivian Cersei is alive, what she has to say would be very enlightening.
Vivian's testimony of a white blonde-haired man named Beau, last seen with the victims, was clearly a crucial part of this case. Finding her, if she was still around, would be imperative. And as for Beau,
I would just like to hear what his version of that night was.
Right.
Yeah.
Do you know much about where he is and what he does now or anything?
No. We were not able to locate him. One of the difficulties with this case is how little attention it received even when it was happening. 35 years later, I mean, I guess with all of these people, the caveat is if they're still alive.
my first order of business was tracking down Vivian Searcy. This proved to be, well, impossible. I only found one person in the entire country with that name. She was nowhere near California, and her history didn't add up. Back in 1985, Vivian was homeless. She moved out of Rainbow Village right after the murders, and who knows where she went next. This was proving to be a dead end, at least for now. But I had something else lined up. Remember that email I received from a stranger? The one that said, "I'm interested and tempted to tell a tale about a Grateful Dead mystery that may have put an innocent man in jail for a murder that happened in Rainbow Village in 1985. This guy. We exchanged a few more emails, and he agreed to tell me his story. But he wanted to do it in person.
We have an attendance on Dawson
Carpenter. He lives in Oregon. And to be honest with you, I had no idea what I was getting into. Due to COVID-19, we met at a local restaurant with an outdoor patio, socially distanced across the table. His name was Robert.
In my inbox, it just popped up in there that there was this podcast that was being put together and that it was about the Grateful Dead, murder mystery type thing. When I saw that, it wasn't too long before this all started bubbling up in my mind. True crime, Grateful Dead. I have a little story that might be of interest. I moved to California in 85 with my girlfriend and a couple other friends. We got an apartment. I was 20 years old and, you know, it was my first apartment. And so I was willing to let people stay there. It's a good idea, isn't it? But we didn't have any, you know, structure. After a while, I'd start seeing people in my apartment that I really didn't know who they were. Oh, they must be my buddy's friend that he met on tour. Somehow these are fellow travelers. They need a place to stay. I'm fine with that. If I know that you're a fellow deadhead, you're kind of vetted. I can relate to you. There's a certain amount of trust I already have. Now, that trust could be diminished rapidly. This particular story, it's a sad, sad story. I'm not sure that justice was served. This whole thing was mishandled from the very beginning. It's too late for any kind of real justice for Ralph Thomas, but there's missing pieces of the puzzle there.
After a few minutes, it was clear that Robert was very passionate about this story. But to move the needle in a 30-year-old case, he would need to have some pretty compelling information.
This guy, Bo, was invited to move into our apartment.
Bo was his old roommate.
If this was the injustice that seems possible, let's get this straightened out.
Thanks for checking out Dead and Gone. Dead and Gone is written, hosted, and produced by Payne Lindsay and myself, Jake Brennan. Check out my other music and true crime podcast, Disgraceland, about musicians getting away with murder and behaving very badly, as well as Payne's other shows, Radio Rental, Atlanta Monster, and Up and Vanished. Dead and Gone is a production of Tenderfoot TV and Double Elvis and brought to you by Cadence 13 and executive produced by Donald Albright, Payne Lindsay, Brady Sadler, and myself. This show is produced by Mike Rooney, mixed by Cooper Skinner, music by Makeup and Vanity Set, with additional music services by Ryan Spraker, edited by Sean Cahalan, production coordination by Matt Bowden, copy edited by Pat Healy, writing assistance by Taylor Bettinson, cover design by Matt Mills for MattMillsArt.com. Special thanks to Oren Rosenbaum and Grace Royer from UTA, Ryan Nord, Jesse Nord, and Matthew Papa from the Nord Group, Chris Corcoran and the Cadence 13 team, Beck Media and Marketing, Station 16, and the teams at Tenderfoot TV and Double Elvis. Thanks for checking out Dead and Gone. Episodes drop every Thursday. Please make sure you're subscribed to the show wherever you get your podcasts. If you like what you hear, leave a review on Apple Podcasts or give us a shout out on social media with the hashtag Dead and Gone, and you might win a free Dead and Gone show poster designed by Nate Gonzalez. Thanks for your support.